Sudanese protesters take to the streets against the military coup that's derailed the country's transition to civilian rule. The Syrian military says it has intercepted several Israeli missiles fired at the Damascus countryside. And the Arab League is concerned about the deterioration of ties between Persian Gulf Arab states and Lebanon following a Lebanese minister's remarks about the war in Yemen. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. The first story this hour takes us to Sudan, where at least two people have been killed during anti-coup protests in the Sudanese city of Omdurman. The Central Committee of Sudanese Doctors says the two had died from gunshot wounds. Demonstrations are currently underway across the country demanding a civilian-led government. Sudanese security forces were deployed in large numbers in the capital, Khartoum, closing the majority of main roads and bridges. Phone lines were also largely down. Last Monday, the military detained Sudan's civilian leadership, dissolved the government, and declared a state of emergency. The coup was met with a chorus of international condemnation. At least 13 protesters have been killed in clashes with security forces. Syria says its air defenses have intercepted missiles fired from the direction of Israeli-occupied territories toward the Damascus suburbs. The Syrian media quoted a defense official as saying some of the surface-to-surface missiles were blocked by Syrian air defenses. The strikes injured two soldiers and caused material damage. Israeli attacks are usually carried out at night, but this time it happened in broad daylight. The Tel Aviv regime frequently performs missile attacks inside of Syria, despite the country's repeated calls for action from the United Nations. The attacks mainly target the Syrian military, as well as resistance fighters battling foreign-backed terrorists. Well, the Arab League has expressed deep concern about worsening ties between Persian Gulf Arab states and Lebanon amid a row over the Saudi war on Yemen. The organization has warned against any measures that would negatively affect Lebanon's ailing economy. It has also urged Beirut to act quickly to ease the tensions. In a recent interview, Lebanon's information minister called the Saudi-led war on Yemen futile and demanded an end to it. George Khordaihi also said Yemen's Ansarullah forces are only defending their country against external aggression. The kingdom and its regional allies have taken a series of punitive measures against Beirut over his remarks. In the latest escalation, Kuwait has ordered Lebanon's charge d'affaires to leave the country.
Saudi Arabia has ordered the Lebanese ambassador to the country to leave over what the kingdom refers to as offensive remarks by the Lebanese information minister regarding the ongoing war by Saudi-led coalition against Yemen. Saudi Arabia has also imposed a ban on all imports from Lebanon. At the same time, the Saudi Foreign Ministry has expressed regret over the deteriorating relations between Riyadh and Beirut, accusing Lebanon of ignorance and failure to take corrective measures to improve the bilateral ties between the two countries. All these came amid a call by Lebanese Information Minister George Khordaihi for an end to the Saudi-sponsored war on Yemen, a devastating war with a simultaneous siege that have been killing and displacing Yemenis for more than 6 years now, a catastrophe that even the United Nations refers to as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Recently, the kingdom also classified a Beirut-based financial charity body as a terrorist entity, froze all the association's assets, and banned all sorts of financial transactions with it, all for the charity's ties with Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah. Lebanon-Saudi relations have been in free fall for years, but the kingdom's flagrant interference in Lebanon's internal affairs has intensified in the past few years. The highlight of that would be the unexpected resignation of Lebanese Prime Minister Saad Hariri during a trip to Riyadh under Saudi degrading treatment and pressure. A year before that, Hariri had reached a power-sharing deal with Hezbollah and had attempted to convince Riyadh of the need to work with the resistance group. In 2016, Saudi Arabia halted $1 billion worth of aid to the Lebanese army, citing the country's regional ties. Those are followed by the latest series of Saudi sanctions against Lebanon, including the prohibition of its citizens from traveling to the country. However, Riyadh does not always act alone. Similar to its conduct in Yemen with regional allies and under Western support, it pressures some other Persian Gulf countries, sometimes through threats and sometimes through leverages, to fill in its footsteps. After controversy over Hariri's resignation, Kuwait and the UAE joined the kingdom to urge their citizens to leave Lebanon. The UAE, Bahrain, and Kuwait all summoned their envoys in Lebanon in protest to the recent statements of the Lebanese information minister. In 2017, the very same group of countries, alongside Egypt, collectively severed their ties with Qatar, citing a variety of reasons, including support for terrorism or Qatar's backing of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas, allegations that were all strongly rejected by Doha.
I believe that people will raise their voices inside and outside Saudi Arabia, and they cannot win a war in which they kill people for speaking out their mind. This is they should stop this policy and stop the war, stop the hooliganism, and stop the attack on neighboring countries and on their own citizens. That's the best for everyone.
Therefore, one can say that the current Saudi measures against Lebanon, especially at the time of heightened economic instability and insecurity, would do nothing but deteriorate the already worsening crises in the Arab country.
Now, the Yemeni army has made further advances in Madar province, taking control of a military camp near the provincial capital. Yemeni forces captured the Umrish camp after fierce clashes with Saudi-backed militants. The camp is located in the Juba district south of Madar province. The Yemeni army also gained control over the Jarsha district. Now, these are the latest in a series of gains that the Yemeni army has made in recent days. Since last year, Madar has turned into a focus of Yemeni army operations. It is the last stronghold of the Saudi-backed forces there. And now back to our top story this hour regarding the latest situation in Sudan. We're going to cross over to London. I'd like to welcome Jonathan Ofeansa, publisher of Africa Briefing. Thank you so much for being with us. Well, where do you see this going? I mean, it's been days now since the coup, and of course today there was a call for a million people to protest, and we see protesters on the streets, and we have reports of at least two people being killed. Where do you see this situation going?
The situation is a bit fluid, but I believe with the pressure, with the internal pressure, especially with the demonstrations by the Sudanese people, and also some pressure from, some external pressures from the U.S., from the allies of Sudan in the Middle East and elsewhere, we believe that the junta led by General Buhan will eventually try a dialogue with, you know, the ousted civilian regime and come to some sort of an acceptable arrangement for the country. Already, General Buhan has promised a new civilian cabinet within 1 week. And it's also made overtures to the deposed Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok, who is insisting that he will not enter into any dialogue with the junta until the coup is renounced. And I believe Hamdok wouldn't have made such a statement if he felt that was be negotiating from a weak position. So I believe, it is my belief, that in due course the trend will be reversed, and we will see a restoration of a civilian interim administration in the country.
So you feel that that's going to happen very soon? I mean, it's interesting that if the leaders of the junta wanted to talk to the civilian part of the government and try to work out a deal, why do you think that they have done what they have done? I mean, why take on a coup at this point in time instead of perhaps just trying to establish that dialogue to begin with? Your assessment of this coup in general and why it took place?
The military, you know, are tainted. Look, let's take the war in Darfur. Okay, I mean, already the former strongman, al-Bashir, is going to be placed before the International Criminal Court in The Hague. Okay, and some of these general soldiers are tainted by atrocities in Darfur. Not only that, some are also tainted by some slaves they might have, you know, been involved in within the old Bashir regime.
Mm-hmm.
So it was their fear that at the end of, you know, if a full democracy, you know, is restored or as planned for 2023, some of them might face trial. So they took a creative measure just to save their skins. But what I believe they didn't anticipate was the resistance by the Sudanese people. Okay, already about 70 people, civilians have been killed and about 170 injured. But still, they have not been able to crush the will of the Sudanese people as witnessed by the 1 million march held today. So I think they'll be forced, you know, to negotiate, to dialogue with the outside civilian part of the administration led by the outside Prime Minister, Abdallah Hamdok.
Okay, and on that note, I appreciate you being with us. Out of London, Jonathan Ofei Ansah, publisher of Africa Briefing. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, the vaccination campaign is gaining momentum in Iran, with over 52 million people having received the first dose of the jab. Health authorities say over 33 million are now fully vaccinated. More than 84,000 have also received a third booster. Iran is now among the top 20 countries to have offered COVID jabs per capita. This has caused COVID-related figures to go down, with authorities reporting 123 daily fatalities on Friday, the lowest in almost 4 months. On Saturday, however, 128 new deaths were posted. Nearly 7,000 new cases were also diagnosed. Iran has logged 126,000 deaths and nearly 6 million cases in all. The leaders of the world's most advanced nations are arriving in the Italian capital of Rome to attend the G20 summit there. Climate change, health, and the relaunch of the global economy top the agenda of the two-day talks. The participants are under pressure to make headway on tackling global warming. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has warned G20 leaders to show more action to overcome mistrust to advance climate goals. Well, the event comes amid protests and inaction to address the problems of climate change. On Friday, thousands of school students staged a rally calling on the G20 summit to deal with the crisis. Other groups, including the charity Oxfam, also held a flash mob in Rome. They demanded world leaders end global inequity of access to coronavirus vaccines and treatment.
About 4,000 high school students took to the streets of the Italian capital to stage a rally against the upcoming G20 summit of world leaders. Pupils from secondary schools called on the summit's participants to stop the injustices that, quote, have led the planet to the climate crisis and invest significantly in public education as a way to give them a future.
The G20 summit will reportedly focus on climate change, health, and the global economic recovery.
We already know for sure that the world leaders will not opt to invest in public health, social welfare, or in fixing the climate crisis. Quite the contrary, their resolutions will be taken in support of banks and large multinationals.
We are here because our school system is on its knees. Public education must be a priority. World leaders must understand it.
Also on Friday, charities Oxfam, Amnesty International and Emergency held a flash mob in Rome's city center demanding world leaders to end global inequality of access to vaccines and coronavirus treatments. According to charities representatives, billions of people around the world are denied access to COVID vaccine because big pharmas are actively blocking other manufacturers from producing much-needed doses and continue to prioritize selling vaccines to rich countries.
The situation is very serious because in low-income countries at the moment, less than 2% of the population have been fully vaccinated, while in high-income countries, the average is more than 60%.
A large security operation will be enforced with a 10 square kilometer maximum security area in the Eur Quarter, the district surrounding the Congress Center where the G20 summit is taking place. The authorities are wary of the danger that anti-vax extremists and black blocs may pose if they infiltrate the protests. Airspace is closed over Rome and border controls have been enhanced in the attempt to keep away violent protesters.
The G20 summit kicks off on Saturday. Up to 6,000 police officers along with 500 soldiers will be deployed in the Italian capital as authorities fear violent demonstrations during the meeting. Max Civili, Rome.
And with that brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin. Thanks so much for staying with me.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
Afghan debacle has dashed European hopes that the transition from Donald Trump to Joe Biden would restore order and meaning in relations. We now present you an article written by Daniel Williams, a former foreign correspondent for the Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, and Miami Herald, and a former researcher for Human Rights Watch. The piece is titled Broken U.S. Leadership, A Specter Haunting Europe. the wake of the chaotic evacuation of Europeans and Afghans from Kabul airport, NATO allies worry about the reliability of the United States and the competence of President Joe Biden's government. Adding to widespread vexation is the feeling that Washington generally disdains Europe and undervalues the alliance. It marks a sharp reversal of European opinion since Joe Biden took office in January. Having replaced the hostile Donald Trump, European leaders expressed confidence that a steady and expert hand had returned to guide U.S. foreign policy. Adults were back in charge was a common refrain. But after Joe Biden's ill-planned exit from Afghanistan, criticism exploded across the European continent. Josep Borrell, the European Union's top diplomat, said, "It's a failure of the Western world, and it's a game-changer for international relations." He added, "The European Union must be able to intervene to protect our interests when the Americans don't want to be involved." Allies lost 1,145 soldiers over 20 years, while about 2,400 Americans died in Afghanistan. Tens of thousands of Afghans were killed, of course. The first line of criticism focused on Joe Biden's timetable for pulling out and security preparations for the evacuation of thousands of potential refugees. His withdrawal decision was made back in April, but the mass evacuation only began on 14th to 17th of August, days before the deadline he had firmly set for all U.S. occupation troops to exit Afghanistan. He also pulled out 2,500 U.S. troops before the exodus got on the way, then had to send 5,000 back in to handle the crisis. All the while, Joe Biden expressed confidence that Afghanistan would not collapse to the Taliban anytime soon, but allies were baffled. In the British Parliament, the House of Commons, Theresa May, the former Prime Minister, expressed European frustration in sarcastic tones. "Did we just think we had to follow the United States and on a wing and a prayer it would be all right?" Joe Biden made tactical decisions without discussions with allies. To many, it suggested contempt for NATO counsel. It also forced them to hastily send their own forces into Kabul to arrange their own evacuations of diplomats and allied Afghans. Johann Wadepohl, a parliament leader in the German Chancellor Angela Merkel's Christian Democratic Union, CDU, remarked, "Nobody asked us whether it was a good idea to leave Afghanistan in such a quick way." Ireland's David O'Sullivan, a former European Union ambassador to the United States, said, "The immediate feeling around this whole situation is that perhaps there should have been more consultations and more joint planning." President Biden's unilateral decision-making highlighted Europe's debilitating reliance on the United States, not only for combat power, but for logistics. Once President Biden spoke, Europeans had no other choice but to scramble on American planes, not only to get some of their own 7,000 soldiers out, but also Afghan allies who had worked for them. The Carnegie Endowment for Peace, in a report on the situation, declared NATO has indisputable dependence on the United States. The Afghan finale renewed a long search for a compelling allied role following the collapse of the former Soviet Union. In the 1990s, American diplomats suggested that the future lay in NATO embarking on missions beyond European boundaries as a kind of global police force. The mantra was, out of area or out of business, in the words of late Richard Holbrooke, a top American diplomat at the time. The United Nations authorized NATO's first venture outside the alliance's bounds in 1994, when the global body asked it to bomb Serbian artillery and fighter planes. 1999, NATO went to war with Serbia again, this time without United Nations authorization. In the name of a humanitarian intervention to supposedly inhibit ethnic cleansing of Muslims from Kosovo, NATO jets bombed Serbian forces inside the breakaway region and targeted Serbia itself, including its capital, Belgrade. The suspicious 9/11 attacks on New York and Washington provided NATO the occasion to go to war in Asia in defense of its chief member, the United States of America. At the war's beginning, Afghan forces, with the help of U.S. air power, overthrew Afghanistan's Taliban rulers. Later, American occupation forces claimed that they have chased al-Qaeda terrorists out of the country. NATO forces arrived on the scene more than a year later, both for combat and to take part in disjointed effort to supposedly reconstruct Afghanistan and build its military and governing capabilities. That project, of course, came to a crashing end on 31st of August. For a future NATO role, one option is to revert to its original mission, to supposedly defend Europe from Russia. But even that mission raises issues of NATO's reach. The main action is not within NATO's borders, but on its doorstep in Ukraine. Is NATO, with the United States presumably in the lead, prepared to defend Ukraine from Russia's alleged military intervention? It hasn't so far. Would it reverse Moscow's 2014 annexation of Crimea and someday make Ukraine an alliance member? Neither of this seems on the horizon. Prospective hints may emerge when Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky visits Joe Biden in Washington. He's concerned that Biden is bent on appeasing Russia, so to focus wholly on China. His evidence? Biden withdrew opposition to and sanctions on companies building the Nord Stream 2 natural gas pipeline that runs under the Baltic Sea from Russia to Germany. Because the pipeline bypasses Ukraine, it robs Kiev of $1.2 billion in yearly transit fees and means Moscow can cut off supplies to Ukraine without upsetting Western Europe. Joe Biden once called the pipeline, the Nord Stream 2, a threat to European security, but once in office, backed off at Germany's insistence. Ukraine officials have ruefully noted Joe Biden's focus on corruption in Ukraine, which, though an important issue, strikes them as a way to divert attention from the military threat to the east. Further afield, Joe Biden wants NATO to buy into U.S. plans to confront China in East Asia and impede its naval expansion in nearby waters. It is not clear that NATO, either fully or in part, would follow Joe Biden on such a distant and potentially fraught venture. In June, France's President Emmanuel Macron argued against a NATO hard line on China. Macron reminded Biden that the group is an Atlantic, not Pacific, alliance. NATO may simply prefer to stick to its home continent of Europe. Some members complain NATO has been deficient in controlling Europe's southern Mediterranean frontier against uncontrolled migration. The Afghan withdrawal has further raised concerns about a new refugee flood into Europe. It's all feeding second thoughts about the alliance and U.S. leadership. Katharina Emschermann, a director of Berlin's Hartie School Postgraduate Center for International Security, said, "Part of the discord that we're seeing now is probably also rooted in the sense of unease about how things are going to go in the future, as well as uncertainty in Europe about the future course of American foreign policy. It is not clear yet if the uncertainty also results from the kind of U.S. policy lodestar that guided much American policy during the Cold War, that is, the need to contain the former Soviet Union. The post-Cold War expansion of U.S. global policy sometimes seems to value alliances and sometimes wants to go it alone. Its policy tools oscillate between promiscuous military interventions and under-resourced nation-building and diplomacy. Or perhaps the consternation reflects a hangover from the performance of America's last two presidents, the bombastic and unpredictable Donald J. Trump, followed by an unsteady Joseph Biden. In a time of bewilderment, a country that produces such leaders is not instilling confidence in Europe.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear listeners. Thank you so very much for being with us again on another episode of The Lantern. Alhamdulillah rabbil alameen that we've been given this chance and opportunity. I hope you guys find that the little discussions we have on the show beneficial. You know, one of the things that children do a lot is comparing. I don't even want to start with parents that compare their children with other children in front of their children. It's really detrimental for the child's mental health and growth. Please don't do that. But children also often have a habit of comparing the things that they have with other people. Let's listen to a short story about this, and we're going to be right back.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, dear brothers and sisters, salam, peace, and salutations of Allah the Almighty be upon all of you. So welcome to this episode of Lantern. As usual, we have an interesting story. It starts like this. A group of highly established alumni got together to visit their old university professor. The conversation among them soon turned into complaints about their stressful work and life. The professor went to his kitchen and returned with a large pot of coffee and an assortment of cups, including porcelain, plastic, glass, crystal, some plain-looking, some expensive, and some exquisite. The professor told them to help themselves to the coffee. After all the students had a cup of coffee in their hands, the professor said, "Did you notice all the nice-looking cups are taken and only the plain inexpensive ones are left behind? While it is normal for everyone to want the best for themselves, but that is the source of problems and stress in your life. The cup itself adds no quality to the coffee. In most of the cases, it's just more expensive and hides what we drink," professor continued. "What all of you really wanted was coffee, not the cup. But all of you consciously went for good-looking expensive cups and then began eyeing on each other's cups. Let's consider that life is the coffee and the jobs, houses, cars, things, money, and position are the cups. The type of the cup we have does not define or change the quality of our lives. Now, what is the moral of this story for today? Sometimes we fail to enjoy the coffee by concentrating only on the cup we have. Being happy doesn't mean everything around you is perfect. It means you've decided to see beyond the imperfections and find peace. And the peace lies within you, not in your career, jobs, or the houses you have."
lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
So, newsflash, apparently we as adults do that too sometimes. We sometimes compare ourselves and our own lives with others, especially after this whole social media phenomenon appeared. We do that even more often. We scroll through Instagram and we see people hashtagging, living their best lives, you know, glowing and drinking water and staying in their own lanes, good vibes only. And we're like, oh darn, I wish I had her skin, I wish I had her figure, I wish I had his car, I wish I had their family, their home, their job, their career, their, you know, I don't know, lifestyle. Oh, they're such couple goals. Oh, they're so perfect. Oh, I'm so miserable. Oh, why can't I be as good as they are? And, you know, here's the thing. First of all, Instagram is full of baloney because filters. Secondly, filters. You know, on social media, we filter everything about ourselves, not just the imperfections that really we did not know even existed until Instagram filters appeared, but also the imperfections in our lives. No one is going to post, or well, some people do post every detail of their lives. But those who are keen on promoting themselves as, you know, life gurus and being really positive, influencers, quote-unquote, I hate that word, by the way. Or maybe positive gurus are more realistic. Life gurus are more realistic. But those, they know that are good vibes only, living their best lives and stuff like that, they will not post about their bad hair day. Or even if they do, they're going to put it up in a really cute, messy bun with an adorable, oversized t-shirt and a, you know, duck face pose and hashtag messy hair, bad hair day. And you'd be like, girl, please. You know? They're not going to talk about the ugly side of their lives that often. Even if they do, they're not going to focus on it because that defeats the objective of posting about yourself for more likes and this and that. A lot of people are moving toward being more realistic, saying it as it is, so that more people can relate, and I think that's a wonderful thing. Also, I'm not saying that we should just post and share negative aspects of our lives. There should be a balance. There should be a sense of community and compassion. There should be a safe space for understanding, and there should definitely not be any comparison. There's a hadith from Imam Sajjad alayhi salam where His Eminence teaches us the only place it's okay for us to compare, and it's in the state of our spirituality and our wealth. Hear me out. Imam alayhi salam says, when it comes to our spirituality, our spiritual growth, and us bettering ourselves and self-refinement and whatnot, we should compare ourselves with those that are better. Compare ourselves with the ulama, compare ourselves with the shahada, compare ourselves with the ahlul bayt, set them as standard and criteria, and try to, you know, the higher you set the bar, the more you will try and put effort into receiving it. In terms of our wealth, compare ourselves with those who have less. Why? Because it's about growth. It's not about who has more, who has less, who's doing better, who's doing worse. It's about growth. Okay? Everything in life. When I have a lot of wealth and I look to those who have less than me, I will practice gratitude. I will practice compassion. I will practice kindness. I will practice charity. I will practice appreciation for the things I have, big and small. I will practice thankfulness toward Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for blessing me with all the things that I have. And when I look to those who are more than me in spirituality, I will practice discipline, principle, self-betterment. I will try harder. I'll put more effort into bettering myself and create a balance. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanallah.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A new report describes two January 6 protest insiders who claimed they worked back-to-back with several Republican House members, including Representatives Paul Gosar, Lauren Boebert, Mo Brooks, Madison Cawthorn, Andy Biggs, Louis Gohmert, and Marjorie Taylor Greene, and their senior staffers, who they allege were intimately involved in planning both Trump's efforts to overturn his election loss and the January 6th events that turned violent. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by William Rivers Pitt, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Explosive Report Says GOP Congress Members Helped Plan January 6th Capitol Attack. Stay tuned for more. January 6 protest organizers say they participated in dozens of planning meetings with members of Congress and the White House staff, wrote the Rolling Stone headline. The report describes two January 6 protest insiders who claim they worked back-to-back with several Republican House members, including Representatives Paul Gosar, Lauren Boebert, Mo Brooks, Madison Cawthorn, Andy Biggs, Louis Gohmert and Marjorie Taylor Greene and their senior staffers, who they allege were intimately involved in planning both Trump's efforts to overturn his election loss and the January 6 events that turned violent. These two January 6 organizers have begun communicating with congressional investigators and sharing new information about what happened when the former president's supporters stormed the U.S. Capitol, according to Rolling Stone. This is the first report that the committee is hearing major new allegations from potential cooperating witnesses. While there have been prior indications that members of Congress were involved, this is also the first account detailing their purported role and its scope. The two sources also claim they interacted with members of Trump's team, including former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, who they describe as having had an opportunity to prevent the violence. If confirmed, this report would put the word bombshell to shame. and would also go a long way toward explaining why Trump's congressional allies have been turning themselves inside out trying to change the subject. An unfortunate grain of salt must be taken with this, however. Rolling Stone's journalistic reputation took a hit over its reporting on the University of Virginia rape scandal 7 years ago. Because of this, confirmation by other news outlets is essential. There is good reason to believe the Rolling Stone report is sound. First and foremost, it reveals that these two sources have been actively cooperating with the January 6th Commission, providing specific details on who was involved with which aspects of the insurrection. Such a claim could and likely would be debunked by members of that committee if it weren't accurate. The Rolling Stone report comes in tandem with a damning Washington Post report detailing how space within the Willard Hotel in Washington, D.C. was used as a war room for efforts to overthrow the 2020 election. They called it the Command Center, reports the Post. A set of rooms and suites in Posh Willard Hotel, a block from the White House, where some of President Donald Trump's most loyal lieutenants were working day and night with one goal in mind: overturning the results of the 2020 election. Their activities included finding and publicizing alleged evidence of fraud, urging members of state legislatures to challenge Biden's victory, and calling on the Trump-supporting public to press Republican officials in key states. Central to this effort was the enormous pressure brought to bear against Vice President Mike Pence to refuse to certify the election results on the same day as the insurrection took place. While Pence wobbled badly under the strain, seeking advice at one point from fellow former Indiana Senator Dan Quayle, he ultimately chose to certify the election results. At the peak of the day's violence, Pence was whisked from the building by the Secret Service as a mob of furious Trump supporters stormed the halls of Capitol demanding his head. The Willard operation was so serious, in fact, that its members brought in a retired Army colonel named Phil Waldron, who specialized in psychological operations, to aid in the overall effort. Multiple witnesses are set to testify under subpoena before the committee about what they knew of premeditated plans for violence on January 6th and how high up the chain that premeditation went. One of them, former Trump advisor Steve Bannon, who said on his podcast the day before the violence that all hell is going to break loose and tomorrow is game day, is ignoring his subpoena. By a vote of 229-202, the House approved a measure holding Bannon in contempt of Congress, and his legal fate now rests in the strangely quiescent hands of Attorney General Merrick Garland. There are many moving pieces to this, but a sense is growing that those involved in planning and executing the attempt overthrow of the election on January 6th may be running out of room to maneuver. Representative Betty Thompson, chair of the January 6th investigation committee, told CBS News, "There is no question the attack that day was premeditated." One wonders if Thompson is among the committee members who have spoken to the sources in the Rolling Stone report. It sure sounds like it. 30 years ago this week, the remnants of Hurricane Grace were engulfed by a powerful nor'easter in the waters off the mid-Atlantic states. The combined system, jostled by a barometric ridge and a cold front, charged north as a subtropical cyclone before becoming a widely atypical hurricane itself. The no-name storm, or the Halloween storm as it came to be called, raged for days and killed 13 people. No long after it passed, a National Weather Service forecaster named Robert Case and an adventure author named Sebastian Junger gave it a name that stuck, the perfect storm. 30 years later, another perfect storm is brewing over Washington, D.C. If it comes together just so, the obedience minions of Donald Trump, along with Trump himself, could be exposed as active practitioners of treason within the halls of the very government they purported to serve. You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent, and FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim. a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا ومولانا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته dear listeners welcome to another episode of Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio. Knowledge is something that we all desire, we all want, and sometimes we even take pride in having it. That's a different discussion altogether. But there's something very important when it comes to the search and the seeking of knowledge. And it's also a fundamental, you know, ethical point for the person who is seeking it to understand. And that point can be, you know, quite clearly seen in this tradition that we will mention today. That how a person should act when it comes to the searching of knowledge. And how he should see his own knowledge. This is also important. So in this tradition, the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam is reported to have said that the most knowledgeable of people, the a'lamu an-nas, that person who has the most knowledge, is he who adds other people's knowledge to his own. Now here there are two important points that we would like to draw our dear listeners' attention to. One, that this person who seeks knowledge, in order for him to take other people's knowledge and add it to his own, he has to first realize that he is not, or he does not contain or not possess all the knowledge, that he is not arrogant. He understands that there are certain things he does not know. He understands that he is ignorant regarding certain things. Therefore, he goes and finds out that maybe this person knows this. Maybe this person knows that. And he goes and he finds out and he adds it to his own knowledge. This is an important point to understand. That when you are seeking knowledge, do not think that you know everything or you are know-it-all, as it said. No. Other people also know things. Go and get it from. And this leads to the second point, that the knowledge that other people have is also worth knowing. Therefore, if it is worth knowing, it is worth adding. And therefore, we understand that as you add to your knowledge increases, and therefore you will know that you can go and get from other people who at first you may not have been able to understand and get knowledge from them. So these are two important points to understand. One, do not be arrogant, do not think you are know-it-all. Because if that is the case, what are you adding? You have nothing to add. Second, other people also have knowledge. They also have worth. And the knowledge that they have, and the worth of knowing that, and the worth of knowing that knowledge which they have, is also extremely important for us to understand in order for us to become, or any person who wishes to become, the most knowledgeable of people. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to enable us to practice this tradition in our lives. Until next time, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
This one leg.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of information.
The Spotlight.